Here we go. For my ongoing series on data justice, today I spoke to author and activist Brendan C. Byrne about Palantir, data mining, and the seasteading movement. Wait, let me set you up here. I'm a tech worker, and I have a lot of reservations about how the tech industry relates to society at large. Especially in San Francisco, there's been a lot of movement activism organizing against these private buses that take workers from San Francisco down to Silicon Valley. I'm a member of a group that was organizing against Palantir, and Brendan was the kind of ringleader of this group. And we're going public for the first time here talking about it on WOOC. Brendan, tell us about this effort to bring light to what Palantir has been up to.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure if I was entitled to a ringleader. There was a bunch of us who were all doing the organizing. One of the things that we were trying to do was focus on how regular engineers, I mean regular, but like, you know, everyday people who go to work and work for these huge data harvesting or data analyzing companies, even if what the specific things they're working on, even the specific cases they're working on, aren't, you know, involved in the mass deportation agenda, even if they're not, you know, actively enabling serious, harmful, problems, they're still bolstering the company and they're still doing work for the company. And what we're trying to do is confront them just sort of in person, not necessarily aggressively, but just we were flyering right outside, Dan and I were, as well as a bunch of other people. The New York City offices, which is sort of tucked away on this really opulent little side street in, the Meatpacking District in New York City.
If I can just cut in, some listeners may not be familiar with what Palantir does. What is their business exactly?
Well, they try to sort of associate it with like a lot of mystical BS. But basically what they do is they aggregate a lot of data and they try to like draw points between it, and which sounds kind of like not a big deal. And actually sort of one of the things that I guess sparked this conversation, this interview, is the big article on Palantir New Orleans, which was that ProPublica or who published that?
I think that was in The Verge. This is...
That's right. That was The Verge.
Winston published this on the 27th.
Right. And I was talking to one of our friends, and I saw that... And one of the things she said was, she's like, none of the stuff in there is like really that hard to do. they're not being ultra specific about the stuff they're doing. They're just taking the names of people who get in traffic stops, or like this person is like cousins with this person who's in jail for selling drugs, and then they're creating sort of a map, and then sort of mapping all this data they have against where people live, where they work, you know, what schools they go to, what schools their kids go to, and then sort of drawing this map and then taking that information and then trying to figure out, well, where do we think the next gang shooting is going to happen? What this leads to is a sort of weird idea, and I think James Carville and Mary Madeline, I'm not sure if I'm saying her name right, they're sort of like the prime power couple from like the early 90s, like Republican Democrat. They were both like, he's a Democrat, she's a Republican, and they're both big in New Orleans, and they helped bring Palantir into the New Orleans situation. And one of the things that she said was, she was like, you know, you don't really have to worry about this unless, you know, your cousin was a drug dealer. And this is like the most ridiculous thing in the world. Like, okay, everyone's fine unless they happen to be related to someone who's done something wrong. I'm definitely related to people who've done something wrong. And I think, you know, a lot of people out there are. So that's sort of what Palantir does. And they do this for, sort of famously for international policing or military use. You know, they worked with the CIA. They're famously sort of stum on whether or not they helped provide information that enabled the U.S. Special Forces to kill Osama bin Laden. But they sort of do this, like, nudge-wink thing. We're like, yeah, we killed bin Laden. But now they're sort of trying to do more and more domestic stuff. And that is, I guess, New Orleans is a big part of that. And I've heard vague rumors about Detroit, but that's really vague, and I don't want to, like, say that that's real.
One of the controversies with Palantir has also been their coordination with the government finding undocumented immigrants and assisting with the deportation regime.
Yeah, yeah. So that's interesting. There's a lot of stuff going on there. Palantir was building or has built a series of sort of systems that were helping DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, to, I believe, specifically track gang violence like MS-13 or stuff like that. And one of the things that we were very unsure about, we were trying to get more information on this, is that whether or not, like, ICE, the people who are doing, you know, the sub-agency that's doing, you know, rounding up people and, like, you know, doing traffic stops and stuff like this and, you know, actively deporting people, was able to get access to that those systems. And, you know, sort of Palantir employees who we talked to claimed they weren't. And their reasoning for this was pretty technical in the sense that they were like, well, the people from, you know, the DHS think the people at ICE are sort of like morons and don't want to share, like, the system with them. Which, you know, sounds a little bit like right if you think about sort of like how federal bureaucracies are sort of infamously bad at coordinating with each other. But at the same time, it's like, I mean, one of the purposes of the Department of Homeland Security was to make organizational federal bureaucracy easier to manage. And so we basically just have, like, a bunch of people who work at Palantir's, like, word or supposition, not even their word, that ICE won't be using their tech to, you know, to help deport people. And so, yeah, that's kind of a problem.
It seems like there's a lot of secrecy around to what degree their technology is effective, or even when it's being used in a criminal case. In that Verge article about New Orleans, there was a case that was brought as a result of this sort of data mining. And during the discovery in the case, they didn't disclose that this was a part of how the defendant was chosen. And it seems like nobody in New Orleans city government knew that it was happening. It was sort of like this secret process that was happening. So why all this secrecy? I suspect it's that, to some degree, it's snake oil, and it's just an excuse to, like, harass people with this magical data mining stuff going on.
Well, that is sort of one of the big questions about all these sort of Silicon Valley or Silicon Valley-derived, like, cyber-libertarian, you know, ideas. And, you know, this sort of extends across, you know, cryptocurrency like Bitcoin or these sort of weird, like, Ponzi scheme situations like seasteading. Exactly how much of it is, like, snake oil, how much of it is sort of Silicon Valley continuing the great American tradition of hucksterdom, and how much of it is, like, seriously, you know, real damaging, you know, like, systems. How much, you know, if it works properly, it's going to be really bad. Or how much, but is it working properly in the first place? And if it's not, how much of the sort of the hucksters bought their own shtick? And it's a weird situation, and I'm not inside any of these organizations or systems, so I don't know. But either way, it's kind of worrying because it definitely sort of like the ideology leaks into the mainstream. And a big thing Palantir does is Palantir is named after one of the seeing stones in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings trilogy. And sort of like Peter Thiel loves Tolkien, like, imagery and one of the big things, you know, it's sort of like the eternal battle of light against darkness. And, you know, he sees himself on the side of the light, and Palantir is sort of like this, you know, like, force of good. And, you know, sort of that sort of like reductive black and white imagery has obviously been used as a means of, you know, imperialism and colonialism and racism throughout, you know, the last, what, 500, 600, 700, 800 years, whatever. And so it's now it's sort of being repurposed by this sort of like magical, like, tech, you know, BS basically.
You mentioned seasteading earlier, and I wanted to draw attention to this article that you wrote in Rhizome about this group of seasteaders who were documented by this filmmaker under the art group Dis magazine, I believe. And maybe you can describe the scenario. It's kind of this weird situation. And
What's interesting about this is just something that the filmmakers and Dis turned Rhizome and a number of their outlets onto, which is that these two filmmakers had gone, I don't think they were invited, I think they sort of asked permission and were allowed to go on to this this sort of like fact-finding mission where these members of the Seasteading Institute were going to meet members of the French Polynesian community and government, which is where the Seasteading Institute wants to start a seastead, a functional sort of like offshore libertarian utopia, which will be outside of all laws, but most importantly, outside of tax laws. So, you know, you sort of have all these sort of stereotypical, you know, middle-aged white dudes who are like hanging out at what looks to be like a, you know, sort of a tropical island paradise, or at least, you know, sort of like the commercialized version of that, and sort of behaving in this sort of like sort of vaguely creepy way. And, you know, obviously, the film they shot didn't make the Institute look that good. But what the Institute had made them do, the filmmakers, was sign a contract stating the Institute would have access to all the footage and could recombine it and reuse it in whatever form they wanted to. And the filmmakers, I think, thought that this was just going to be like, oh, they'll just use it for commercial purposes. Or, like, you know, if they want to put together, like, a little, like pamphlet, video pamphlet or whatever. But what they did instead was they released their own documentary on YouTube with the exact same search engine optimization, the exact same name, with a trailer that was almost exactly the same. So it was kind of like they were just trying to like push out the critical documentary and release their own and sort of replace it, which obviously has, you know, sort of worrying symmetries to the way that, you know, fake news is thought about or sort of pushed out there by these extreme right-wing organizations and people. We're going to replace reality with our own version of reality.
It sounds like a more extreme version of one of those films that gets recut a million times. You know, there's like the Blade Runner final cut, but there's also like the director's cut, and there's five other cuts probably. Technically, I guess if it was in IMDb, it would be a single title with like two versions that happen to not look anything like the other one.
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. I talked to one of the filmmakers about this, or I emailed with him about this, and what he said was he was actually kind of excited about the fact that someone had repurposed his footage to make a statement that was totally opposite to the one he was trying to make, just from an artistic, like, he was angry about it, but from an artistic point of view, he thought it was pretty cool.
Well, that's all the time we have, Brendan, but thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Dan.
That was Brendan C. Byrne talking about Palantir, tech activism, and seasteading as part of my ongoing series on data justice.